Chapter 61. My dear owls, I reckon it would ruin the book, that is, make it necessary to pigeonhole it and leave it unpublished. I couldn't publish it without a very responsible name to support my own on the title page, because it has so much of my own matter in it. I bought Osgood's rights for $3,000 cash. I have paid Clark $800, and owe him $700 more, which must of course be paid, whether I publish or not. Yet I fully recognize that I have no sort of moral right to let that ancient and procrastinated contract hamper you in any way, and I most certainly won't. So, it is my decision, after thinking over and rejecting the idea of trying, to buy permission of the Harpers for $2,500 to use your name, a proposition which they would hate to refuse to a man in a perplexed position, and yet would naturally have to refuse it, to pigeonhole the Ibury. Not destroy it, but merely pigeonhole it and wait a few years, and see what new notion Providence will take concerning it. He will not desert us now, after putting in 4 licks to our 1 on this book all this time. It really seems in a sense discourteous, not to call it Providence's Library of Humor. Now that deal is all settled, the next question is, do you need, and must you require that $2,000 now? Since last March, you know, I am carrying a mighty load, solitary and alone, General Grant's book, and must carry it till the first volume is 30 days old, January 1st, before the relief money will begin to flow in. From now till the 1st of January, every dollar is as valuable to me as it could be to a famishing tramp. If you can wait till then, I mean without discomfort, without inconvenience, it will be a large accommodation to me. But I will not allow you to do this favor, if it will discommode you. So, speak right out, frankly, and if you need the money I will go out on the highway and get it, using violence, if necessary. Mind, I am not in financial difficulties, and am not going to be. I am merely a starving beggar standing outside the door of plenty obstructed by a Yale time lock which is set for January 1st. I can stand it, and stand it perfectly well, but the days do seem to fool along considerable slower than they used to. I am mighty glad you are with the Harpers. I have noticed that good men in their employ go there to stay. Yours ever, Mark. In the next letter we begin to get some idea of the size of Mark Twain's first publishing venture, and a brief summary of results may not be out of place here. The Grant Life was issued in 2 volumes. In the early months of the year, when the agent's canvas was just beginning, Mark Twain, with what seems now almost clairvoyant vision, prophesied a sale of 300,000 sets. The actual sales ran somewhat more than this number. On February 27, 1886, Charles 50, Webster and Company paid to Mrs. Grant the largest single royalty check in the history of book publishing. The amount of it was $200,000. Subsequent checks increased the aggregate return to considerably more than double this figure. In a memorandum made by Clemens, in the midst of the canvass he wrote, "During 100 consecutive days the sales, i.e., subscriptions, of General Grant's book averaged 3,000 sets, 6,000 single volumes, per day." Roughly stated, Mrs. Grant's income during all that time was $5,000 a day. To W.D. Howells, in Boston. Hotel Normandy, New York, December 2, 85. My dear Howells, I told Webster, this afternoon, to send you that $2,000, but he is in such a rush, these first days of publication, that he may possibly forget it. So I write lest I forget it too. Remind me, if he should forget. When I postponed you lately, I did it, because I thought I should be cramped for money until January, but that has turned out to be an error, so I hasten to cut short the postponement. I judge by the newspapers that you are in Auburndale, but I don't know it officially. I've got the first volume launched safely, Consequently, half of the suspense is over, and I am that much nearer the goal. We've bound and shipped 200,000 books, and by the 10th, she'll finish and ship the remaining 125,000 of the first edition. I got nervous, and came down to help pump up the binderies. And I mean to stay here pretty much all the time till the first days of March, when the second volume will issue. Shan't have so much trouble this time, though, if we get to press pretty soon, because we can get more binderies than are to be had in front of the holidays. One lives and learns. I find it takes 7 binderies 4 months to bind 325,000 books. This is a good book to publish. I heard a canvasser say, yesterday, that while delivering 11 books he took 7 new subscriptions. But we shall be in a hell of a fix, if that goes on it will all up the binderies again. Here's ever Mark. November 30th that year was Mark Twain's 50th birthday, an event noticed by the newspapers generally, and especially observed by many of his friends. Warner, Stockton and many others sent letters. Andrew Lang contributed a fine poem, also Oliver Wendell Holmes, the latter by special request of Miss Gilder for the critic. These attentions came as a sort of crowning happiness at the end of a golden year. At no time in his life were Mark Twain's fortunes and prospects brighter. He had a beautiful family and a perfect home. Also, he had great prosperity. The reading tour with Cable had been a fine success. His latest book, The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, had added largely to his fame and income. The publication of the Grant memoirs had been a dazzling triumph. Mark Twain had become recognized, not only as America's most distinguished author, but as its most envied publisher. And now, with his 50th birthday, had come this laurel from Holmes, last of the Brahmins, to add a touch of glory to all the rest. We feel his exultation in his note of acknowledgement. To Dr. Oliver Wendell Holmes, in Boston. Dear Mr. Holmes, I shall never be able to tell you the half of how proud you have made me. If I could, you would say you were nearly paid for the trouble you took. And then the family. If I can convey the electrical surprise and gratitude and exultation of the wife and the children last night, when they happened upon that critic where I had, with artful artlessness, spread it open and retired out of view, to see what would happen, well, it was great, and fine and beautiful to see, and made me feel as the victor feels, when the shouting hosts march by, and if you also could have seen it, you would have said the account was squared. For I have brought them up in your company, as in the company of a warm and friendly, and beneficent but far distant son. And so, for you to do this thing was for the son, to send down out of the skies the miracle of a special ray, and transfigure me before their faces. I knew what that poem would be to them. I knew it would raise me up to remote and shining heights in their eyes, to very fellowship with the chambered Nautilus itself, and that from that fellowship they could never more dissociate me, while they should live, and so I made sure to be by when the surprise should come. Charles Dudley Warner is charmed with the poem for its own felicitous sake, and so indeed am I, but more because it has drawn the sting of my 50th year, taken away the pain of it, the grief of it, the somehow shame of it, and made me glad and proud it happened. With reverence and affection, sincerely yours, S. 50. Clemens. Holmes wrote with his own hand: Did Miss Gilder tell you I had 23 letters spread out for answer when her suggestion came about your anniversary? I stopped my correspondence and made my letters wait until the lines were done. End of this Project Gutenberg text of letters vol. 3, by Mark Twain. Mark Twain's letters 1886-1900, arranged with comment by Albert Bigelow Payne, Volume IV. XXVI, Letters, 1886-87. Jane Clemens Romance. Unmailed Letters, etc. When Clemens had been platforming with Cable and returned to Hartford for his Christmas vacation, the Warner and Clemens families had joined in preparing for him a surprise performance of The Prince and the Pauper. The Clemens household was always given to theatricals, and it was about this time that scenery and a stage were prepared mainly by the sculptor Gerhardt for these home performances, after which productions of The Prince and the Pauper were given with considerable regularity to audiences consisting of parents and invited friends. The subject is a fascinating one, but it has been dwelt upon elsewhere. In Mark Twain, A Biography, Chaps, Cliff and CLX, we get a glimpse of one of these occasions as well as of Mark Twain's financial progress in the next brief note. To W.D. Howells, in Boston, January 3, 86. My dear Howells, the date set for The Prince and Pauper play is 10 days hence, January 13. I hope you and Pilla can take a train that arrives here during the day. The one that leaves Boston toward the end of the afternoon would be a trifle late. The performance would have already begun when you reached the house. I'm out of the woods. On the last day of the year I had paid out $182.00 on the grant book, and it was totally free from debt. Here's ever Mark. Mark Twain's mother was a woman of sturdy character, and with a keen sense of humor and tender sympathies. Her husband, John Marshall Clemens, had been a man of high moral character, honored by all who knew him, respected and apparently loved by his wife. No one would ever have supposed that during all her years of marriage, and almost to her death, she carried a secret romance that would only be told at last in the weary disappointment of old age. It is a curious story, and it came to light in this curious way. To W.D. Howells, in Boston, Hartford, May 19, 86. My dear Howells, here's a secret. A most curious and pathetic romance, which has just come to light. Read these things, but don't mention them. Last fall, my old mother, then 82, took a notion to attend a convention of old settlers of the Mississippi Valley in an Iowa town. My brother's wife was astonished, and represented to her the hardships and fatigues of such a trip, and said my mother might possibly not even survive them, and said there could be no possible interest for her in such a meeting and such a crowd. But my mother insisted, and persisted, and finally gained her point. They started, and all the way my mother was young again with excitement, interest, eagerness, anticipation. They reached the town and the hotel. My mother strode with the same eagerness in her eye and her step to the counter and said, "Is Dr. Barrett of St. Louis here?" "No. He was here, but he returned to St. Louis this morning." "Will he come again?" "No." My mother turned away, the fire all gone from her, and said, "Let us go home." They went straight back to Keokuk. My mother sat silent and thinking for many days, a thing which had never happened before. Then one day she said, "I will tell you a secret. When I was 18, a young medical student named Barrett lived in Columbia, Kentucky, 18 miles away, and he used to ride over to see me. This continued for some time. I loved him with my whole heart, and I knew that he felt the same toward me, though no words had been spoken. He was too bashful to speak, he could not do it. Everybody supposed we were engaged, took it for granted we were, but we were not. By and by there was to be a party in a neighboring town, and he wrote my uncle telling him his feelings, and asking him to drive me over in his buggy, and let him, Barrett, drive me back, so that he might have that opportunity to propose. My uncle should have done as he was asked, without explaining anything to me, but instead, he read me the letter. And then, of course, I could not go and did not. He, Barrett, left the country presently, and I, to stop the clacking tongues, and to show him that I did not care, married, in a pet. In all these 64 years I have not seen him since. I saw in a paper that he was going to attend that old settlers' convention. Only 3 hours before we reached that hotel, he had been standing there. Since then, her memory is wholly faded out and gone. And now she writes letters to the schoolmates who had been dead 40 years, and wonders why they neglect her and do not answer. Think of her carrying that pathetic burden in her old heart 64 years, and no human being ever suspecting it. Ears ever, Mark. We do not get the idea from this letter that those two long ago sweethearts quarreled, but Mark Twain once spoke of their having done so, and there may have been a disagreement, assuming that there was a subsequent meeting. It does not matter now. And speaking of it, Mark Twain once said, it is as pathetic a romance as any that has crossed the field of my personal experience in a long lifetime.
When Mark Twain, a biography, was written, this letter had not come to light, and the matter was stated there in accordance with Mark Twain's latest memory of it.
Howells wrote, after all, how poor and hackneyed all the inventions are compared with the simple and stately facts. Who could have imagined such a heartbreak as that? Yet it went along with the fulfillment of everyday duty, and made no more noise than a grave underfoot. I doubt if fiction will ever get the knack of such things. Jane Clemens now lived with her son Orion and his wife, in Keokuk, where she was more contented than elsewhere. In these later days her memory had become erratic, her realization of events about her uncertain, but there were times when she was quite her former self, remembering clearly and talking with her old-time gaiety of spirit. Mark Twain frequently sent her playful letters to amuse her, letters full of such boyish gaiety as had amused her long years before. The one that follows is a fair example. It was written after a visit which Clemens and his family had paid to Keokuk. To Jane Clemens, in Keokuk. Elmira, August 7, 86. Dear Ma, I heard that Molly and Orion and Pamela had been sick, but I... Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.